Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to Tea Break Time Travel, where every month we look at a different archaeological object and take you on a journey into their past. Hello and welcome to episode 8 of Tea Break Time Travel. I'm your host, Matilda Siebrecht, and today I am savouring a black vanilla tea. Very, very simple. And joining me on my tea break today is fellow archaeologist Pierre Huber. And what are you drinking today? You're also on tea. The Dutch are famous tea drinkers, so I imagine it's tea.
Yeah, I'm actually drinking Yorkshire tea, black tea as well. Yeah,
oh, even better. You're getting into the full spirit of things.
Yeah, I visited Yorkshire this summer and I brought home some souvenirs, including a big carton of black tea.
I found it really funny, actually, because to me, the British were always like the quintessential tea drinkers. And it was a really big thing that like the British are tea drinkers and that's what it is. But then actually, when I moved to the Netherlands, apparently the Dutch are the largest consumers of tea in the world, which I
really
didn't realize. Yeah. Of which you do. I mean, you have a lot of teas.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. We also drink a lot of coffee.
That's true.
So up there in
hot beverages in general.
Yeah, yeah. Hot beverages in general, maybe.
Okay, so we've established we're both tea drinkers. That's good. And indeed, the Dutch just enjoy drinking hot beverages in general. But we are not here to talk about tea, even though I think that that would make a fantastic podcast episode. We are here to talk about traveling back in time or archaeology more specifically. And I always find people always ask, how do I get into archaeology? How does one become an archaeologist? And every single person I've had on so far has a different story. So to keep in line with that, what is your story? How did you get introduced to the world of archaeology?
Yeah, so actually as a child, I was already doing stuff like burying roadkill and digging up the bones.
Really? Okay, sorry, I wasn't expecting that. So I was expecting, like, I was already interested in like Roman history and things. Okay,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
Very specific.
A very specific, maybe a little bit dark, but no,
I mean, was that archaeology or is that just like
well, the digging part was already something that I was interested in, apparently.
Okay.
And I think I was mostly inspired by things like Jurassic Park, which of course it's not archaeology, let me stress that. Again, you know, like that's paleontology. Yeah, so already had an interest in history for a long time as a child. And I remember visiting the Harz in Germany with my parents. We went fossil hunting. We visited the Neanderthal. Uh-huh. So, and also the Neanderthal Museum, of course. So that, I think that was an important spark for me developing my interest. And then when I went on to choose my studies in university, I didn't really know very clearly what I wanted to do, but I looked around. And archaeology was one of the options in Groningen. And it just really clicked. It was combining a lot of my interests. Like I was interested in history, sociology, these kind of things. But also in, you know, like doing practical stuff, excavating, working with material. That really appealed to me. So that's why I chose it. And I never looked back.
That's true, actually. Archaeology is that fantastic combination of, like, it has all of the theory and you can you can just do theoretical stuff if you want to, but then it's also really practically focused as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember going to these different orientation days at university when I was still in high school. Yeah, a lot of the things that I was interested in just involved only reading, a lot of reading. And archaeology does involve a lot of reading, but yeah, just combining that with some practical stuff really appealed to me.
Mm-hmm. Out of curiosity, has your thoughts of what archaeology is changed a lot since that initial time when you first were interested in it?
Yeah, definitely. It's a difficult question, actually. I really have to go back to when I was 18, which is 13 years ago.
No one knows.
I don't really remember what I thought archaeology was at the time. I think I had a quite romantic idea about it, you know, especially about commercial archaeology. I thought it would be very adventurous. But reality, it can be quite, how do you say it?
Don't say it. It's adventurous. We'll stick with that. Okay. I think, it was similar for me a little bit, because I think I actually was reluctant to get into archaeology because to me it was very like classics focused and very kind of, I had that view of it, you know? The sort of, oh, you have to know the Bible back to front and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. That was sort of what I thought of as archaeology. But actually, since I've realized that it's more about a way of thinking and a way of interpreting the world. And yeah, it's a lot better than I initially thought it was, which is nice.
Yeah, I remember early on in my studies, or even when I started out, I already was interested mostly in prehistory. Mm. Yeah, also because you can really explore things that are not written down yet anywhere, you know, like it's you deal with stuff that's completely new to anyone, I suppose, you know.
Yeah. I feel like I'm biasing people's perception of archaeology through this podcast, because I just realized that I think all of my guests have pretty much, we've talked about prehistoric objects, which there are lots of other very interesting things. I need to make sure to get some medievalists and things on.
Yeah. And I think particularly later periods are very interesting for archaeology, because you can combine, you know, like stuff from the written source material with findings from the field. And that can be very interesting, complementary or contrasting.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. And because yes, you have this written sources, and I always say, oh, I love prehistory because we don't have the written sources. So, you know, it's sort of more imaginative, but actually the written sources are also very biased, right? Because they were written by people who had an opinion. So it's another form of interpreting objects, I suppose, in a way as well. So, still, I love prehistory, but obviously historic periods, very interesting as well, which leads nicely actually into my next question, which is, if you could travel back in time, as the podcast series suggests, is the theme of this podcast, where would you go and why?
Yeah, I think this is a very difficult question because every time period probably has its struggles, right? Mm. But I think just to satisfy my curiosity, I think I would like to go to the late Mesolithic, to the early Neolithic transition in the Netherlands, to see how hunter-gatherers and early farmers interacted in this region.
Hmm.
Yeah. And also because I think this period in the Netherlands or in Northwest Europe in general was a period in which, you know, like natural resources were very abundant. And, you know, I think if you would be able to join a group in that time, you would live comfortably. Hopefully.
Do you think that you would survive well if you were put into late Mesolithic, early Neolithic life?
Not on my own, no. I would definitely need to join a group of hunter-gatherers or early farmers and make myself useful somehow.
Yeah. It's always my thought. I'm like, I'd love to think that I could just go back and then, you know, slide seamlessly into society, but I'd probably be that, you know, person that they all have to look after and would eventually just be kind of left behind somewhere because they can't be bothered anymore.
Yeah, I think your skill levels would be like that of a child at that time, you know, like you really have to get a tutor to learn everything. All of the practical skills that you don't know. You don't know any of the plant names and stuff, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so then maybe later periods would be better for me, actually, because I could just be, you know, a highborn lady and not do anything or whatever and just kind of live the easy life. But anyway, which just shows how much I know about medieval life, because who knows if that was actually the case. But okay, well, thank you very much for joining me on my tea break today. And before we focus on today's object, let's first journey back, of course, around 7,000 years this time. The exact date is not very important because the object that we're looking for on this particular journey was around for a very, very long time. And we are now in a very rocky landscape, cliffs and peaks sweeping up to meet the dusk-streaked sky and down into the darkening valley below. The air is crisp and dry, but it's also filled with the scent of wood smoke. We turn and see a small group of people, all of them gathered around a small fire. They're trying to make the most of these final hours of fading sunlight to finish off a couple of tasks. One is examining a piece of flint, turning it slowly in one hand and holding a large, slightly rounded pebble in the other. Fragments of flint are mixed in with the grass and stone around their feet. After a minute of examination, the figure grunts and settles the flint down against their thigh, raising the pebble in the other hand. The hand moves slowly up and down, gauging the distance and force required before striking suddenly downwards. There's a loud and beautifully pitched crack, and a perfect segment of flint breaks off. The hits continue, interspersed with many examinations, turning, grunting, until what's left is a relatively small, thin piece of flint with a central ridge tapering down into sharp edges. By this time, the light is fading into dusk, and the figure decides to give up for the day, storing their creation carefully in a small leather pouch on their belt. Now, I, of course, may have got all of this completely wrong in terms of how you create these objects, but today we are looking at flint blade technology. And we'll get into the details soon, but as always, I had to have a look at the most asked questions on the internet, courtesy of Google search autofill. There were actually a surprisingly small amount of questions about flint blades. I guess they're not something that people look up a lot, but I came up with a couple. First one was, what were flint blades used for? Nice and simple question. Obviously a very easy answer, right, Pierre?
Yeah, actually, I'm not surprised that it's not a very popular search term, but because this is quite niche. But yeah, flint blades were obviously used for their cutting edge, right? You already illustrated very nicely that flint blade will taper down into like a sharp edge. Yeah, you could use a flint blade for cutting anything, cutting plant materials, butchering animals. And you don't necessarily need a blade for that. You could use any flake. But preparing flint during the napping process so that you can make blades will allow you to get like a standardized form for all of your tool production as well. So they were often used as blanks to make arrowheads out of them, barbs, or, tools like scrapers or burins, which were used to work hide or bone or antler.
Okay. So they were almost like a starting piece to potentially be transformed into something else.
Yeah, I think in flint's terminology, we usually talk about blades as just a specific type of flake, which is a flake that is roughly twice as long as it is wide. And we also imply with using the word blade that some type of systematic way of producing them was used. Mm. So you can sort of accidentally create a blade while napping flakes. But, you know, we tend to think of a blade production as a systematic thing, you know, like you prepare a core, a piece of flint into a core, and then you nap it in a certain way so that you can create a series of blades, which you can then use as knives or as blanks for other tools. Yeah.
Okay, interesting. So they really were just a very diverse and kind of multifaceted, excuse the pun, tool in that respect. Okay, that's very interesting. And I imagine then, because they could be used for so many things, the next question is, are flint blades strong? Which I imagine the answer is yes, or are they not considered the strongest of tools?
Yeah, they're very strong. They're actually, the correct term is that they're very hard.
Okay.
So you have this scale of hardness called the Mohs scale, and that goes from 1 to 10, in which 10 is, you know, like very hard material such as diamond. And flint is about as hard as a steel nail, about 7 on the 6 or 7 on the scale of Mohs. But it is very brittle, so you can easily snap a flint blade, or it can break when you use it. Yeah, to work antler, for example, if you put pressure on it, it can splinter. But it is very hard.
Yeah. And is it the kind of object that you, because it's sort of a very specific shape, is it the kind of object that you also see it being like retouched a lot and kind of adapted to still be a blade, but just a different kind of blade? Or is it the kind of object that once the edges has chipped off or once it's broken in a particular way, it can't be used for anything anymore?
So exactly. When you use a blade to create different tools, you are retouching it basically into the shape that is desired. So, for example, you'll blunt one edge to make a scraper out of it. But once it's been bruised, you can't really use it that well for cutting anymore. You know, it's the most sharp. If you want to use a blade for cutting, it's the most sharp just after it was snapped. And if you've been using it for a while and it's been bruised and it's been sort of blunted, it's no use to kind of try to sharpen it again or something. You'll just use a different flake or blade to cut with.
Okay. Which is nice, though, that if you have your, you know, lovely blade that you've spent time creating and then you accidentally break one edge or something, you can just make it into something else and then it's still useful, which is, I don't know, nice recycling, yeah. I guess. And then the final question, which I guess we've already touched on a little bit, but maybe you could go into a tiny bit more detail, is how do you make a flint blade? So you've mentioned the terms napping, flint napping. I assume that probably most of the people listening do understand what that is, but imagine for a second that I am a complete archaeological novice. I have no idea about flint. Could you maybe provide a very kind of simple overview of how you might create a flint blade?
Yeah, so you need two elements. You need a piece of flint, obviously, and you need some kind of hammer, which can be a pebble, so a hammer stone, or maybe an antler hammer. And what happens if you just strike a piece of flint with a hammer, you will create a flake, which is just a broad piece of flint with a sharp edge, which is fine. But if you want to create blades, you will need to do a lot more preparation. And the main things you need to prepare is a platform that will have an acute edge. So you need something like 70 degree edge with the rest of the core. And then you will have to prepare some kind of ridge on the working face of the piece of flint. Because if you strike a piece of flint, the energy of the strike will sort of travel through the material because the material is very homogeneous and it has the same properties in every direction. So basically every product from a strike to a piece of flint will sort of be, it will sort of follow the fracture dynamics, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah.
Right? So like it will create a conchoidal fracture and then it will, you know, like that will split off. So you need to prepare a ridge, which is called a crest, if you want to create a very long conchoidal fracture along this piece of flint. And if you've managed to get the first bit off, the first blade off, which will be a crested blade, then you will have two ridges from the negative of that blade. And then you can use those ridges as starting points to nap off your second and third blade. And then you'll have more ridges to work from. So that's kind of the process for blade production. And it involves a lot of corrections, you know, so you have to sort of keep that platform at the right angle, especially if you've been napping for a while, you'll sort of damage the edge of the platform. So you need to do a lot of work in between.
Which I admit is something that I just could never get the hang of while napping. I think it's just because I'm so impatient and it would be like, but I don't like, I, you know, you have, like you say, you have to do 10 steps before you can do the first kind of preparatory thing. And I was just like, no, but I want to do it now.
I want it now.
Which is, well, I think we'll talk about that a little more later. So I won't go into too much detail now, but yeah. So it basically, it's not, you mentioned before flakes sometimes being similar to flint blades or vice versa, or you can make a blade from a flake, but indeed it's not just hitting it and hoping that something nice comes off. You have to prepare it a lot is what you're saying. So
yeah, it requires a lot of insight into how fracture mechanics work and how this particular piece of flint has to be prepared, because, you know, like every piece of flint is different. It will have like weird knobs or weird shapes, and you have to nap off the right bits to create that that preform.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Our U.S.-based restoration specialists are experts dedicated to helping solve your identity theft issues. And all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. So we'll reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Help protect your information this tax season with LifeLock. Save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/aware.
Okay, well, thank you for that. So we know a little bit more about the sort of basics of flint blades, but maybe you could tell us even more about this subject. I mean, it sounds like it's a subject that you could probably write volumes on, and I'm sure people have. For this section, let's talk a little bit more about it. So flint blades have been around, I guess, quite a long time because they seem such a nice, versatile object. But when do they sort of first appear in the archaeological record? What's kind of the oldest date that we have for flint blades?
Yeah, so I have to admit, I'm mostly focused on Northwest Europe, but I did do a little bit of research to prepare for this question, and I did see that actually the earliest evidence for flint blades seems to be in South Africa. It's around 500,000 years ago.
Wow.
So that's very, very early.
Yeah.
And this type of flint knapping, this style of technology, was probably lost and rediscovered several times, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, in Europe, it appears with the early modern humans, the Auric Nation culture, but it's also seen on sites of the latest Neanderthals, so the Mousterian culture. And that's around 40,000 years ago.
Okay. But so, I mean, they've been around for nearly as long as stone tools then, I imagine.
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
It's probably not the earliest. Like the earliest stone tools were flakes, and they're not as old. Like blade technology is not as old as hand axe technology, for example. But it's quite old. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Which is funny because I would imagine that don't worry, I'm not going to quiz you about hand axes now. But I'm just thinking about it because to me, a hand axe seems like a much more complicated object to make. So the fact that they were around before blades, but then I guess, yeah, it's just what you need and what survives as well, I suppose, in the ground.
Yeah, but I think that's interesting. I don't know if it is more complicated. I think both are kind of difficult. I think the preparation stage for making flint blades kind of resembles making a hand axe, right? You have to do this alternating flaking to create this ridge that you can start the first blade from. But I think the point is really that these are different styles of technology that you learn from your teachers, from your parents, from your kin. Mm-hmm. And if your group just doesn't do blades, then you won't learn about blades. Right.
Yeah. Which actually is interesting that you mentioned that. So, I mean, obviously we've talked a little bit about, you know, how you would define a blade and that kind of thing, but indeed, if they're around for such a long time and they're in so many different parts of the world, can you identify almost like styles or kind of cultural development in blade technology or that kind of thing? Or is it sort of homogenous in terms of the how you would define a blade kind of thing or how they appear, should we say?
Yeah, so I actually did, this was kind of the topic of my master thesis research.
Oh, would you look
I'll
at
get
that?
Into that. Yeah. very specifically on the late Paleolithic of the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the differences you'll see in styles of knapping blades are quite subtle, but you can see differences. And I think the assumption here is that since people learn things in like a social context, especially, you know, like practices like knapping, mm-hmm. will resemble the practices of people that they are close to. Because at a certain time, you'll have a certain community of practice, which is just a fancy way of saying there was a certain way we did things. Right? You learn how to make a certain thing, and you will do it that way because you learned it that way. And you'll do it in the same way as your grandfather did or your grandmother did. And you'll do it the same way as your your cousins over in the next village did it,
That's
kind of the big assumption there. And so in that way, you could use napping style or just the whole production process as kind of a marker to study cultural change over time. Yeah. Because in the period that I was interested in during my master thesis, which is the late Paleolithic, as I mentioned, you have these styles developing in, for example, arrowheads, which we use to sort of divide the material culture that we find in Northwest Europe. I will have to go into what these arrowheads looked like, maybe. So all of these arrowheads were made on blades.
Okay.
And there were different ways in which they were made. So some of the groups were using the arrowheads as like a barb, so they would make kind of like a triangular edge. Mm-hmm. And some of them were used just as the point of the arrow, and they were sort of tanged in a certain way so that you could shaft them into the arrow shaft.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I think that styles like that, in the way you create something like an arrowhead, is a bit more subject to change, and you can change it more because it's maybe seen as like a cultural marker, right? So you can see like, oh, this group that comes in from abroad, let's say, they use arrowheads this way. We can do that as well. Or, oh, we want to be more like them. So let's, do it in the same way. These kind of things can happen, which is called...
About to say, now we're getting into proper theoretical vocabulary.
Right, yeah. So this is like lateral...
transmission?
Lateral transmission.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I did this all in my paper. I should know this stuff. Which goes to show people that are listening in. I mean, you can say things in a very nice, clear way, but sometimes if you want to make sure that the theories and the concepts that you're talking about are universally understood, you have to use these slightly complicated terms such as lateral transmission.
Which is just a fancy word of, aping other people, right?
Yeah. So
doing the same thing as your neighbor.
In our papers. That would be so much better. It would definitely cut down the word count, which would be great.
Exactly.
Okay. And do you see, because with the arrowheads, I guess it's more, like you say, you have all these different shapes and things. Do flint blades, though, because, I mean, at least in my mind, I'm seeing them as all roughly the same kind of shape, but do you also see variation in that sort of visual perception, typological kind of view of it? Or is it more subtle than that?
Yeah, I'll get into that. But first, I'll have to sort of do a bit of a preamble about what I was trying to look at. Sorry.
Fine.
So my goal for my thesis was to kind of place a particular cultural group in the Netherlands in the context of the groups that we have in at the same time in the Netherlands and in Germany and more to the south, because this particular group looked very much the same as the German Hamburgian.
Mm-hmm.
But it had...
When you say looked the same, sorry, what do you mean?
Yeah, so... Sorry, yeah.
This is for my own curiosity as well.
So exactly in the way you just asked, the shape of the blades.
Oh, right.
You know,
so
like
we're talking
the way,
about the blades. Yeah.
So
cool, perfect.
Just the shape of the blades and the way they were napping blades. So similar to the Hamburgian culture that we have in Germany and Denmark and Poland and also in the Netherlands.
Uh-huh.
But this group in the Netherlands was making arrowheads in the way they did in England, very similar to what was called the Creswellian culture, which is now called the Late Magdalenian.
Again, good old vocabulary.
There we go. This is getting very specific.
No, it's good. It's just funny because it is, I think, the perfect demonstration of why there are so many definitions and terminology in archaeology. It's just something that inevitably you have to come up with at some point.
And actually that terminology, it's part of what's interesting here, because the reason why it's now called the British Late Magdalenian in Britain and no longer the Croswellian is because the sites in England at that time are so similar to the French material in terms of how they were doing, you know, like the style of napping blades, that they were saying like, okay, actually there is not enough reason to separate these as two different cultures. But the Dutch material doesn't have the same way of napping as the English
Not called the Dutch Magdalenian.
No, but both the Hamburgian and the British Late Magdalenian have their origin in the French Magdalenian, or in like the Magdalenian of Central Europe. Okay. So yeah, so that's kind of what we're looking at that time, is two different migration routes into the north, because these groups were sort of splitting up at the end of the Ice Age. So the last Ice Age sort of warmed up a little bit towards the end. So around 15,000 years ago, it started to become a lot warmer and the tundras were expanding. So people that were up until then restricted to South Germany and France could now move into the north. So they could move into like North Germany, into Denmark. But first they moved into Britain, to the west, around 15,500 years ago. And about 1,000 years later, they moved also from the east of Central Europe into like the northeast, so into North Germany. And these two different groups, they sort of found each other, I think, in the Netherlands.
But hey, you again.
Right.
How was your trip? Our one was great.
Yeah, so I think that was kind of my goal, to sort of understand this group of sites that we have in the Netherlands that have these British style of making arrowheads and this sort of Eastern style of napping flints, right?
Okay. Interesting. That's really fascinating and nice. It's a perfect example of how, changes in technology can show you not just development over time in one place, but indeed how people actually came into contact with each other. Because like you say, if people were learning from their grandfather and, you know, person A learns from their grandfather and person B learns from their grandfather, if those two then meet up and have a kid, who will person C, you know, what will their style look like? You know, it will be, I guess, a sort of mix or something.
Yeah, exactly. And so this was quite difficult to do because it required a lot of statistics, doing all of these little measurements on like a sample of blades from each side. So I looked at things that happen during the fracturing process, right? The way you hit a piece of flint, it will create, you know, like different details on the on the platform and below the platform in the way, you know.
Okay,
like,
so looking at kind of how each flint was made, basically, how each blade was made, I mean.
Yeah, it's kind of an interplay of like preparation, the hardness of the hammer, and also like the way it was swung, and, you know, like the force that was used. This will all have some kind of effect on the way the flint blade looks.
Oh, that's really cool, though, that you can see so much detail about that.
Well, you can't sort of parse all of those details, but it will all have sort of an influence on the conchoidal fracture.
The flake that comes off is the conchoidal fracture, right? Yes, good.
Yeah, well, as it's sort of hits, it will create a bulb and a scar and maybe a lip at the start of the... So these three things can sort of be scored, and you can sort of do statistics on the differences between assemblages in that way.
Okay.
And also I did a lot of refitting, which is just taking all of the blades and flakes and the cores from a site and putting them on the table and just start puzzling.
Nice.
Because basically all of the stuff you find on a site, it probably all came from a couple of chunks of flint, right?
Yeah.
If they were napping on that site, they should, in theory, all fit together if they didn't take a lot of stuff away, which they did. So usually it doesn't all fit together.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Yeah, but this refitting, it does allow you sort of to follow the thought process of the napper. It allows you to see what kind of actions were done first and later, and to see what kind of preparation they did. So that's kind of what I did to sort of characterize these different sites.
Okay, very interesting. Which and I guess is also a nice way to see indeed how, like you were saying, all the different preparation and everything. I can imagine, this is reminding me, I can't remember who it is. Someone makes beautiful like little arrowhead displays, but they frame the arrowhead, but then they also include all of the flakes that are created through creating the arrowhead, like all of the tiny little, you know, what's the word when you're pressing with an antler bit on the end, on the edge to make it nice?
Yeah, the pressure flakes.
Yeah, pressure flakes. Like all of those bits that come off and everything. And it's so interesting because you have this relatively small little arrowhead and then just like 100 flakes around it, which came off during the whole manufacturing process, which I think is a really nice way indeed of kind of visualizing that idea that we were talking about earlier of the fact that these relatively simple looking objects actually need a hell of a lot of preparation to create.
Yeah, that's really cool. I think I've seen that before, but I don't remember.
Oh, Ancient Craft. That was it.
Oh, okay. Ancient Craft.
Which are UK-based.
Right. I follow them on Instagram, I think.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was thinking.
For the listener, this might be a little bit confusing because you're referring now to pressure flaked arrowheads, which were not
used in this period.
They're made out of flakes.
Yeah.
But these are just simply blades that are retouched in a certain shape.
I think in Leiden someone did an example, they had a big glass core and then they made a bunch of blades out of it and then stuck them all back together to show the original core shape. Obviously you had like, it wasn't perfectly together because you had all these sort of smaller edges that had been removed during the sort of blade creation process, but that was also really interesting to see this idea that you were talking about earlier of preparing the core, and then from that, as long as you hit the first one correctly, you can just go do 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 and create a bunch of little ones, which is quite
that's
nice.
Really cool. Yeah, because it's so translucent, you could see all the way through the refit. That would be really nice to see. Yeah,
it's very cool. It's in a display cabinet somewhere in Leiden University.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So if you're ever down.
Not seen it.
but very cool.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So what was your result? I mean, did you see that there was indeed those same similarities, not similarities, the kind of evidence of the, what's it called, lateral transmission that we had?
Yeah, so I think it was quite difficult to argue either way what happened, because what I found basically is that the biggest difference was between the Magdalenian site that I looked at from the southern Netherlands and between the Hamburgian and Creswellian together.
Okay.
And my theory for what's the biggest factor in the difference in napping style is just the availability of raw material. Mm. So in the northern Netherlands and in North Germany as well, all of the flint that's available comes from secondary deposits. So it's flint that has been transported during the Ice Age.
Okay.
By the ice sheet. So the ice sheet sort of pushed all of this material from Scandinavia into Northwest Europe, including like huge boulders that were later in the Neolithic used to make grave monuments, you know, like the Hünenbergen, the dolmen, but also lots of flint. But because of this very slow transporting process, these flints were sort of banged around and they,
right.
You know, like they were also in permafrost, which was thawing and then freezing again, thawing again. So there's lots of little ice cracks in there.
Okay.
So it all of the material that's available in the north is just a lot smaller than what you can get in the south, where the flint is in its primary context, so in the chalk layers,
okay,
where you can just get a huge bit of flint out of there and you can prepare it any way you want. And you can make use of like a very long piece of flint to make very long blades. And that's what they were doing in the Magdalenian, and also in the Magdalenian in Britain, is they were using these very big chunks of flint and they were working them from two sides to make very long blades. And they were preparing for each blade, they were preparing sort of the platform in a very specific way. So it's sort of jutted out in a certain way. You could use that to sort of make sure that the force of the blow would just travel in a straight line down through the core. So you would get very long, very straight blades. And that's what's very characteristic of the late Magdalenian. Okay. But they were also using other strategies for smaller pieces of flint. And that didn't involve a lot of platform preparation at all. And that's what you see in North Germany, in the Hamburgian, and also in the Creswellian in the Netherlands. So I think that, yeah, just raw material is just the biggest.
Yeah, because it's funny, you sort of think about it. I was just trying to think, and it's like, oh, if you have like a plentiful supply of good quality flint, you know, from the kind of raw deposit, the primary deposits, rather than stuff that's already been banged around a lot, then maybe you'd be kind of less care, you know, you wouldn't worry as much because it's like, oh, but it's bound to be fine if I hit it in this way because it doesn't have these fractures and everything. But then at the same time, you have this really nice big bit of flint. You don't want to mess it up and, you know, not do it correctly. So, yeah, I guess both sides would have an argument of how much careful preparation you would want to do for each thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So the whole enigma of the Dutch Creswellian is unsolved still. And it probably will be very difficult to solve it because it's already been discussed for, you know, like 70 years or something.
Oh, okay.
Longer.
Okay, okay.
So,
well, if anyone listening, you know, feels inspired to start their own project on this subject, go ahead.
It's,
lots of things.
And, but I did find some, you know, like the way of flint napping and some sites that are later, at the end of the Hamburgian, for example. You've got some sites where they have good raw material and they are using this kind of classic Magdalenian way of napping. So it doesn't seem like this knowledge was lost.
So
this is kind of interesting. But yeah, so that's kind of a very, very long answer to the question.
No, it was really interesting. Well, I think this is nice because it shows indeed how, you know, just looking at something as allegedly simple as a flint blade can already show stuff like people moving around in the past and how people were learning new things and how people were transmitting knowledge to next generations. So I think that it's nice to go into more detail about this kind of thing with something like this technology. But I'm curious. So, I mean, flints, we know that they were around for a long time. If they kind of, the flint blades, I mean, if the sort of earliest examples of them come from these African sites so long ago, 500,000 years ago, did you say?
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah, wow. I mean, when were they used up until? I mean, they sound like a great tool. Are people still using them? Or sort of when do they start falling out of fashion, shall we say?
Right. I don't think they ever went out of fashion. What did happen is there were different napping styles that sort of developed. So, for example, in the Mesolithic, you'll get more indirect percussion, which they would use, like they would take the piece of flint and they would use like an antler tine, like a bit of antler, to place it where they want to strike it. And then they would strike that instead of
almost like a chisel kind of thing rather than.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they would use like a kind of like a chisel and sort of strike the core indirectly. So you could control more precisely where you want the force sort of to enter the flint chunk. So that's indirect napping. And then you have pressure flaking, which we already talked a little bit about, but you can also use pressure flaking in a very weird way to create very small blades.
Okay.
And this is where you would put like a piece of a very small core. You would put it in like a vise, and you sort of use a very long stick and put the pressure of your upper body onto it.
I've seen someone do this, and it's incredible. Like, I don't understand how you can take such a small piece of and like a long stick. I mean, it's like, I don't know. It's like threading a needle from a meter away using a long straight bit of thin wire or something. Like, to me, that's how it seems. Like, it's so, you have to, I was amazed when I saw that.
It is quite amazing how they do that. And that's the Mesolithic. And still in the Neolithic, of course, they were using flint blades as well. And I think even up until the Bronze Age, right?
Yeah.
And so it's basically metal, I guess, then. Yeah, even in the Bronze Age and the Iron Age in the Netherlands, they were still using flint sometimes.
Yeah, right? Nice.
But what's more popular in these later periods, at least in Northwest Europe, is this pressure flaking that we talked about earlier. So they make these very elaborate daggers and flint arrowheads by just pressure flaking all over the surface of the object, right?
So. Yeah. Which one of the theories around that is that it was to sort of show off how good you were at flint working, right? Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be a functional object. It was just look how gorgeous this flint object is that I've made.
This is something you see in every period. I think there's some very interesting examples of that. So there's this one example of a hand axe where they sort of flaked it in such a way that this fossilized piece of shell is just in the center of the hand axe. Right.
Cool.
So that's something from a Neanderthal site, I think. And I think in the Upper Paleolithic in France, they were doing these very unnecessarily long blades. So they were making flint blades that were up to 50 centimeters long or something.
Wow.
And that's not functional at all. It was just to sort of show off.
Be like, look at me. I can do this without breaking it. Yeah.
Of course, it's functional in the sense that you can break them up.
Making some mini blades. Well, because I think it's Mitchell and Webb, which are a British like comedy duo, did this whole comedy thing about like the Bronze Age has arrived now, and it's like, what do you do? It's like, I'm a flint knapper. Oh, sorry, we don't need knappers in the Bronze Age. What else can you do? It's like, I don't know. It didn't happen that quickly, but like, it is funny to think of all these Neolithic flint knappers and it's the Bronze Age, and they're like, but look, I can make a pretty dagger.
Yeah, I love that sketch. That's incredible.
That's such a good one. Have you seen?
And the other one is like, does bronze still need tying to sticks?
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, of course. Great.
Like, great. <You know? laughs> There's also, what is it? There's an Aardman Animations film that came out a few years ago, called Early Man or something, I think. And it's sort of similar. It's like they have a Stone Age tribe, and then the Bronze Age has arrived, and you've got like the evil Bronze Age people moving in and trying to cut down their woods, and it's very funny. But anyway.
Well, they got that part right. The Bronze Age people were evil.
I better stop recording now. So we did already introduce you and sort of your background in archaeology in the first section of this episode, and we heard a lot about your thesis and the research you've done now, but maybe we can go into a little detail about sort of your own personal experience with this technology and flint blades in general, because we've talked a lot about how you looked a lot at like the different knapping techniques and the methods and all of that kind of stuff. So were you like already experienced in knapping before you started your own research? Like, how was your approach in that respect?
No, unfortunately, I was very inexperienced with knapping. And I did do a little bit of knapping in one of the courses that was offered during the bachelor.
Mm-hmm.
And my thesis supervisor does a bit of knapping. So he showed me, in preparation for my thesis, he showed me like the different types of knapping blades, and so I had his materials to sort of practice refitting with as well. So that was very nice, and I did sort of see him work, and I read a lot about knapping. So I thought, okay, I kind of understand what's happening in the knapping process, right?
Mm-hmm.
But having learned to nap a little bit better since then. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sort of really developed my thinking about
Do you go back to your thesis and go, oh man, if I'd known then what I knew now?
Not necessarily, but I think with the experience of napping, I would have come to conclusions a lot quicker probably. Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is interesting though, because I mean, I think a lot of people assume that in order to research the technology, you do need to be really experienced, like academically, I mean, from an archaeological perspective, you need to already be very experienced in it. And I mean, I work a lot with the Experimental Archaeology Society, and there's so many people who are already, for example, they've been tanning skin since they were 5 years old, or they've been, you know, working with wood since this age, and they just sort of automatically fall into that. But then you have the other side, which are people who maybe aren't very, I mean, they might be crafty, but not particularly prehistoric technology crafty, if that makes sense, or this type of thing, or have that understanding, but still want to look at it. I mean, what are your thoughts on kind of that then, having come from, I guess, a little bit that side of things? What would your kind of suggestions or advice be for that? Or, you know, what are your thoughts on that side of things?
I think it really, really helps if you have some experience with at least, you know, trying to do the thing you are trying to study.
Yeah.
Technology. Yeah. Just trying for a couple of afternoons will already give you such a better sense of like what's possible with this material, what makes sense with a certain material. An example of how I sort of developed my thinking in napping flint is that when I was writing my thesis, I was doing this, you know, with mostly a theoretical background, and I was thinking of every piece of flint as an individual action, as like a reflection of a conscious action. So like each flint is like strike, which someone thinks about, right?
Right.
But in the process of napping, it's much more like muscle memory, much more sort of unconscious, kind of already knowing where you want to go, what you need to do. It's not very, very conscious at all, right? It's just sort of,
You just know.
Well, you don't necessarily know. You just do, kind of.
Right. Yeah.
not everything that's snapped, not every blade or every flake is like a result of a conscious action. Sometimes even one strike will create like a bunch of material at the same time, which you didn't think of, especially if you're inexperienced.
Yeah, which could be, you know, a pleasant surprise or a really annoying one.
And what's very interesting, because since like last year or something, I've gathered some flint from Germany, and I've learned a little bit of napping from a teacher, and I've been using the napping product as well, you know, like using the flakes and blades to sort of work antler. And that has really made me realize some things about stone tools that I didn't really think about before, right? Because if you just take a piece of flint and you want to cut something with it, you definitely don't want a sharp edge cutting into your own skin.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah. Makes a lot of sense. So what you would do then is kind of make that part of the blade blunt. And that will create a certain shape, which we would identify as like a type in archaeology, right? So I think a lot of these types that we find, that we define in archaeology, are very much just a product of their use, which, I mean, that's not something new or anything. But there was this kind of recent, it just came out like last month, right? This paper about back blades. By Justin Pargiter. I don't know how to pronounce his last
Pargiter,
name.
Pargiter, probably.
Pargiter. Yeah.
That's what I would say, and, but who knows?
Yeah, yeah. So Justin Pargiter and colleagues, 2022 in Journal of Archaeological Science Reports. And they found through experimental studies that back blades, which were often assumed to be hafted, that the sort of the blunted bit of the blade was made it better to haft it into like an arrowhead, into like an arrow shaft.
Okay, so
and they
then
found
it's almost like a long blade along the side kind of thing.
Yeah. Or like a barb or
yeah,
something like that. But they found that actually makes it a lot more difficult to haft it. Having this back bit. So and and having a backed blade, having this blunted bit at the end, and will make it a lot more easy to sort of use it with your bare hands.
Yes.
And a cut with it. So I think experimental archaeology in combination with use wear analysis will really make our understanding of material culture a lot better, hopefully, in the coming
years. Let's hope
so,
because that's what I've decided to specialize in.
Exactly, yeah.
So, let's hope the funding agencies agree. But, yeah. No, and I think that's really interesting also that you mentioned that indeed there's a lot of, I guess, tool types or, you know, categories and typological categories that have sort of been created over the years of archaeological research that actually could have just been people having a flake that came off a flint nodule and they were like, oh, but I don't want to cut my finger. You know, like there's so many parts of archaeology that have been so kind of official. And I mean, we've talked, I guess, a little bit about that today as well, right? About the definitions you use and the typological categories and the terminology and everything. And sometimes I do wonder whether it would be a good idea to just get rid of all that and just look at it in terms of, right, this is an item, you know, like this is an object. What could it have been used for? Why could it have been made? And maybe we would actually get very different perspectives on it because of that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. And also just seeing the object as like a combination of things that were done to it to make it useful. So the way it was hafted, for example, if it was sort of retouched to use it for hafting, and the bit that's used for, you know, like cutting or using it as a chisel or something, these kind of elements can also change independently from each other, right? So they might still be the same object, but they change the way it was backed or something, you know? Like, so these kind of things, different elements can change over time on like the same tool.
Yeah. Well, and even the opposite of that, that certain elements that you assume are like, oh yeah, but of course it was like this because of this. And then when you try and use it, you think, huh, actually that doesn't make any sense. Like why on earth? I don't know. I'm doing all of my research on needles at the moment. And there's some things about these bone needles. And it's always just been said like, yeah, cool. They were needles and they were probably using them in this way, similar to how we see in the ethnographic study, you know, analogies that we have and all of this kind of thing. But actually, if you try and use it in that way, it doesn't work. And, you know, it didn't work for me, but it also didn't work for like the experienced people. So I'm working with paleo Inuit needles for people who don't know already. I think I've mentioned it already in this podcast, but I'm not sure. And I was working this summer with Inuit seamstresses who are very experienced and who maybe haven't used bone needles themselves, but their mothers did. And they're the same technique they're using. And yeah, we basically found that there's a lot of assumptions that have been made about these needles that don't really make sense when you try to actually use them yourself. So I think, I'm a big advocate of experimental archaeology, but I think that it does. It gives so much more insight into the materials you're using than a purely kind of theoretical understanding of it.
Yeah, exactly. And these kind of ideas of how a certain type of tool was used, they usually are just copied and pasted throughout the literature, right? Someone says like, oh, this is a burin and it was used to sort of, you know, like work bone in this kind of way. That's usually an assumption from the 1950s or something that has just been sort of repeated ever
that
since.
Someone made in a paper because they needed an extra 100 words and like now it's verbatim. Yeah. Like,
and people will say like, oh yeah, this guy said it was used for this and so. And then, you know, it starts to live its own life. But if you actually will start to try things, you might come to very different conclusions, or if you do use wear. So there's this other example from the Hamburgian where they have this kind of burin, which is called a burin or zinken in German. And it's, you know, like it's retouched in a certain way on the end. And use wear studies actually showed that this end wasn't used to work bone or antler at all. It was just used to haft. that bit of the blade. So it was actually just a half the blade, probably.
Yeah. But if you would just look at it from a purely typological perspective, then you would say it was a burin. Yeah.
Yeah. So
this is basically my thesis. If you want a summary of my thesis, this is it, basically.
Yeah.
There's a lot of assumptions, but if we use microware analysis and experimental archaeology, actually,
you'll upend all of the assumptions.
Yeah. Which I think is important to do, though. I don't know. I feel like archaeology is very... I think that obviously there are changes that are being made, and it is constantly in a bit of a state of development, but I think that a lot of things seem to be still very much stuck in assumptions that, like you say, were made in, you know, the early 1900s. And it's just kind of like, oh yeah, but you know, this is a theory that we use, or like, this is the, I don't know, I'm trying to think of theoretical examples now, but I can't think of any, but there's sort of all these theories or ways of looking at material and all this kind of stuff. And it's sort of assumed, oh yes, but you have to use one of these theories or one of these approaches because that's how we've always done it. And then it's like, well, but maybe there's actually a lot more that we can say if we look with a lot fresher perspective.
Yeah. In a way, this is its own like entrenched community of practice, right?
Academia. Right, yeah. This is the problem.
This is the way you do
theoretical
things.
Approach. Eschewing all the theoretical approaches. That is the new theoretical approach. I don't know. I think that this is something that also a lot of people, we were talking at the very beginning about the kind of assumptions of what archaeology is and, you know, how our idea of what archaeology is has changed since we started potentially doing archaeology. And this was also a big thing for me, was that there's so many, all the terminology that we've used today, you know, there's kind of so many classificatory terms that need to be used, which makes sense because it's such an international discipline. And, you know, if everyone used a different term for something, then no one would have a clue what anyone was talking about. So at some point you have to have these theoretical terms, and I understand that. But that was one thing that really struck me when I started doing it at a further level of research, so we say. So when I got into my master's and when I was reading a lot more papers and all that kind of thing, that really got to me. But I guess I don't know if you've had a similar experience.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
All one of those things. And so by the way, for those who are listening, so Pierre and I actually work at the same university. This is how I managed to corner him in the cafeteria one day and say, hey, you know about flint blades, right? Do you want to come on my podcast and talk about them? And we're both currently conducting our PhD research, although your PhD research is not on flint blades, right?
No, not at all. I don't have any material that I look at myself. So that's kind of a bummer for me.
Although maybe the next
My PhD is on, it's kind of like a big data approach to the late Paleolithic and Mesolithic. So I'm still focused on the period that I was interested in, but I'm sort of gathering legacy data of all of these different sites and sort of bringing that together.
Okay, yeah, nice. Which I always find quite interesting. And like a couple of people I was talking to recently who are sort of still, they're basically trying to work out what to do for their undergraduate, so their bachelor thesis. I was saying but you know, I don't know if I want to go in this direction. And I basically said to them, don't worry, like you can change relatively easily, actually, in archaeology, I find, as long as you have something that's linked to the topic, you know, or you have some experience in some sort of related concept, be it theoretical or the material or the method, or like you say, the time period and the culture, you know, you can actually change quite a lot. Like, you know, you said your PhD is now in a very different area of study. And I think a lot of people worry about that. So about sort of changing topics during their academic career, or that they might be interested in something else. But so do you find, I mean, you said you find it a shame that you're not working with Flint, but I mean, how do you find the experience otherwise?
Yeah, no, it's been good. I think it's not a problem at all to switch topics, to switch radically to something like a different period and a different method.
Yeah.
As long as you sort of, you know, like find the right literature and sort of do your reading and do your courses, and you'll get there.
Yeah.
And for me, for example, I got into this kind of data science-y kind of PhD, which, it required me to sort of learn programming in R, which Yeah, well, which has been a lot of fun for me.
Oh, really?
It's been fun and it's been frustrating at times, but yeah, it's been fun. And I think people would probably worry if they would go into something like this that they would have to already know how to do that. But yeah. I think when you do a PhD, developing those kind of skills are also very much part of the process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, I think is good to know. I mean, like experimental archaeology, right? You know, it's it helps if you already have some knowledge, and maybe you will have to develop those skills as you're doing your research in order to better understand it. But you can technically develop them alongside.
Yeah.
In that respect. Which, yeah, I feel like doing, we don't have to get too much into this, but I feel like doing a PhD is quite seen as quite a sort of elite thing still by a lot of people, and it's sort of seen as but I have to be really specialized in something in order to do a PhD, or I have to be really kind of dedicated to a particular topic, which I do think you do in some respects. But I mean, I think I wish before I'd started that I had kind of understood that actually, like you say, it's just a further part of your training in archaeology, right? It's a further part of making you a researcher or making you an archaeologist or making you whatever it is you want to be, basically. But do you have anything that you wish you'd known before you started?
Actually, I'm going to sort of counter what I said earlier. It would have been better if I already knew how to do programming. Yeah. but it's definitely not an issue like that I had to learn it during the PhD. But yeah, otherwise, I would definitely recommend people who start out to just take the time to do your reading.
Yeah,
because I often felt like very rushed and thinking like, oh, I have to get onto the analysis, you know, like I have to do this and do that and sort of get my data. And then I would not spend enough time preparing, you know, like getting the ideas into my head, you know, like reading what other people have done. And so I really have to sort of keep telling myself like, okay, take your time, just read some articles, you know, read some books.
Yeah. Think of your PhD like a flint blade. You have to do the preparation and, you know,
wow.
In order to create that perfect. Oh, look at me go.
Oh, wow. What an analogy. That's great.
And on that note, I think that marks the end of our debrief today. I think I'm not going to get any better than that. So it's probably time. We have, a lot of reading to do. So we should probably get back to that. But thank you very, very much, Pierre, for joining me today and telling us all about your research. It was fascinating. And if anyone wants to find out more about Pierre's work, is your master's thesis like available to read somewhere? Is it on the university page or?
No, it isn't. Very sorry to say. No, but I have been sort of trying to rework it into like a publication. And that's hopefully forthcoming next year.
Okay. Hopefully. So maybe we at some point you might see these show notes updated with a link to the lovely paper about Clivelandian or whatever they were called, but the Magdalenian and not the this, but yeah. I can't remember the terminology. I'm sorry. The people moving around in the late Paleolithic and taking their flint blades with them, basically. Yeah. There we go. There's your title. So if you'd like to find out more about that, then keep an eye on this page. You can also find out more about Pierre's work now. I'll post some links to his current page and academia, etc.
Yeah.
And if you want to find out about flint blade technology, I'll post that paper that you mentioned as well. You can check the show notes on the podcast homepage. I hope that you all enjoyed our journey today, and see you next month for another episode of Tea Break Time Travel. I hope that you enjoyed our journey today. If you did, make sure to like, follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and I'll see you next month for another episode of Tea Break Time Travel.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.